It's not designed in-house, is it? By the normal
It's not
design
designed by
teams.
Someone with eyes, by the look of it.
It's a Rover R8 and an Audi R8.
And the
R8.
Audi R8.
Well, hello, and welcome to another issue of the Classics World Chat Show. So let's get cracking, guys. I'm joined by Joe Miller.
Hello.
And Jeff Ruggles.
Hi.
Jeff is pretty much fresh back from his trip to the International Mini Meet, which I'm sure we'll discuss very shortly. But let's crack on with what's in the news. So, Jeff, you've just put the Classic Car Buyer 10th of June issue to bed. What's our headline story?
Well, you sort of put a spoiler in there quite early, didn't you? to be honest, our headline story is the International Mini Meeting. And the reason for that is because it took place in Poland, just north of Wrocław, a place called Leszno Airport. And it was a triumphant return to form for an event that we should say has been a little bit beleaguered following the events of last year when it was cancelled at the 11th hour. So there was a little bit of trepidation about what would happen this year. And Mini Cub Polska, they took up the reins, and I'm pleased to report they absolutely smashed it out of the park. It was wonderful, helped by brilliant weather all weekend, but 1,400, 1,500 people there, all the normal activities you'd expect of an IMM. And it, just as you walked around, people were, the spirit was great, the atmosphere was great, and it just felt like a proper IMM again. So it was absolutely wonderful. Yeah, I'm still suffering a little bit.
I'm really pleased you managed to get the words beleaguered and trepidation into the opening news story as well. That's
we've got words of the day already there.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'll put those in the print version, in truth. But
hold the presses. You need to get those words jammed in somehow.
But my only disappointment was I didn't drive. But because the heavens have opened for people driving back, maybe that wasn't such a bad thing. A bit more international news as well to sort of discuss, if you want to call it international news. Of course, there's been the announcement that MG are returning to Europe, and they're planning a factory in Spain, not at Longbridge or Abingdon or Oxford, but Spain. And it's due to open in 2028, costing 200 billion, was it?
A lot. 200 billion euros, yeah.
200 million, sorry, my apologies. That's a lot, isn't it, 200 billion? So, yeah, a little bit controversial, perhaps, that it's not going to be in the UK, but it's going to be in Spain instead, so...
I think it's really interesting. I mean, dispassionately, it's a sensible strategic decision. I think I looked at the numbers. MG has sold over 1 million units in Europe since 2011, since basically coming back to sort of full-blown car production. And 300,000 units were sold in Europe in last year alone. So almost a third of those total sales in 15 years happened last year. So they're on the march, as a lot of these, let's face it, Chinese companies are. But obviously it won't be lost on people that a badge of such notable heritage has chosen to set up a European operation, not in the UK where it sort of originated. Actually, it's quite a sobering thought for all of the European car manufacturers, actually, because car production is massively overspecced in Europe, and a lot of the European companies are really struggling. But
it's not that troubling, to be honest. I mean, when you think the Mark 1 Fiesta was built in Spain, you know, the whole Valencia factory, and they named the engine after it and so on. And you, conversely, back in the sort of 80s and 90s, you had the Japanese building factories over here. It just happened to make because of import levies and so on. I think ultimately you have to remember that, like, again, dispassionately, car companies exist to sell cars and to make money. And if they can make a greater profit by making the same product in a different location, it doesn't really matter. Because when you break it down, it's like saying, yes, it's a British car, but like you say, the vast majority of it isn't built in Britain anyway. If it keeps people employed and it keeps a historic badge on the road, it doesn't really matter where they're built.
Oh, the flip side to that is, obviously, we'd like extra jobs in the UK, wouldn't we? Yeah. That would be nice. But
it's interesting you mentioned the Ford Fiesta, though, Joe, because the second best-selling car in the UK behind the Jaku 7 in March was the Ford Puma, which is built in Romania.
Yes.
So, you know, it's when you mentioned the sort of Valencia factory, for example, well, Ford still had Halewood and Dagenham at the time. So Ford of the UK and Ford of Europe, by then very much one company, had production facilities all over what we would term Western Europe. But now they're kind of, what, in Turkey and Romania, you know, very much they've gone where the wages are lower and perhaps land is more cheaply available.
There's also this sort of made in Europe proposal that you could argue that MG are being quite smart to avoid. I mean, I know Nissan are worried about it and it could discriminate against cars made in Britain. So we'll have to see what happens there. Obviously, nothing has been passed yet, but made in Europe could make it much easier for EU countries to trade between themselves, but kind of leave us out in the cold a little bit. So we have to see what's going to happen with that.
Anyway, yes. Other topic of slightly controversial news stories, gentlemen. Obviously, the other sort of big news talking point that's happened since we last recorded the podcast, again, it's not strictly relevant to our general audience, but it did raise a lot of talk amongst us particularly, was the reveal of the new electric Ferrari.
Is it Luce or Lucy?
I believe it's Luce. Now, if you haven't been misfortunate enough to see this yet, I would suggest you go and Google it, Ferrari Luce, and there's no nice way of saying it, gentlemen. It is not a looker.
It's not designed in-house, is it? By the normal
It's not designed
teams.
By someone with eyes, by the look of it.
No, it's designed by Lovefrom, an agency that I think are also responsible for the iPhone. So they've obviously had lots of success in the past, but whether that translates to
British designer Jonathan Ives, of course, behind the iMac and the iPhone. So
whether that huge success translates to a Ferrari is... it remains to be seen, doesn't it?
All I will say is all the people who were very quick to slag off the new electric Jaguar, suddenly that's not looking quite so bad, is it? That's all I'm going to say about it.
It's interesting you say about the looks, Joe, because I mean, I probably wanted to refrain from saying too much about the looks of it, because ultimately that is subjective. And I've seen plenty of comments to say they don't mind the styling. It's just that it's not styling that befits a Ferrari. You know, if it had a Kia badge on it, probably no one would have batted an eyelid.
That's my problem with it. It's a Ferrari. It's not a Kia or a Hyundai. It's a Ferrari. It should immediately, the second you see it, it should ignite some passion and some enthusiasm. It shouldn't ignite, oh, that's all right. That as soon as it's all right, it's not a Ferrari.
What are you saying, Jerry? You wouldn't pay 450 grand for a Kia?
No, I'm afraid I'll be shopping elsewhere. It's just, I'm sorry. We won't hang on this too much because it is a modern exotic electric car, so it's very much not our wheelhouse. But I will say that they've obviously tried to go in the same kind of direction as Jaguar are going with the Type 01, where it's bold, it's a new direction, blah blah blah. But if that's where Ferrari are going, then frankly they're cooked. I'm sorry, it's horrendous.
Well, as you said, Jeff, it's very much Ferrari's gamble, isn't it? Very much like Jaguar's gamble with its Type 01 or oh dear or whatever you want to call it. But but yes, so that leads us very nicely onto our weekly topic, which is automotive gambles. History will soon tell us whether Jaguar and Ferrari's respective gambles will pay off. But it's not the first time that a car maker has had to sort of take a leap, and whether that was a calculated one or, you know, almost one by necessity. So I wanted us to go through cars that were perhaps perceived at the time to be gambles, and then we can sort of judge whether we think they were a success or a failure. So I think we've all got four suggestions each, which is quite useful. So Jeff, why don't you kick us off with your first automotive gamble?
Appropriately then, a Jaguar.
Very good.
Specifically the XJS of 1975, which was an interesting time to launch a V12, only a V12 at that point, in the wake of a fuel crisis, replaced the beautiful E-Type with a car that had divisive styling, shall we say, at the time, and not offer an open-top version. And the fact that it did about 12 to the gallon. There was a car that probably, come 1980, was teetering on the brink of failure, teetering on the brink of being axed. But it turned around with the high-efficiency V12 engine, which changed the combustion chambers, made it a lot more efficient. Then you had AJ6 engine, so a six-cylinder option, which coincided with having the XJSC, so a cabriolet, finally an open-top. 5 years after that, a fully open-topped car, nicely strengthened, and it just went from strength to strength, didn't it? It lasted for 21 years in the end.
You know, and so more than the E-Type that it replaced.
Yes.
I mean, obviously in a longer time frame, but, you know.
Yeah. So
I think you're right. The XJS is a great lesson in learning from your mistakes, isn't it? Because it started so wild and unusual. By the end, it was just this fabulously refined, wonderful car.
Yeah. A little bit cramped inside, I have to say. But just an iconic. It just became an icon, didn't it? All of those excellent sales, 21-year life. You know, it's still a desirable car today. And yet it could have so easily gone very wrong indeed, but it didn't. Yeah.
I think that's an excellent choice, and I'm slightly gutted I didn't choose that one myself. Anyway, Joe, what about you?
So my first choice, a little bit more modern, similar brand with heritage and legacy, and it's Porsche. And that was when, in 2002, they launched a 4x4. Gentlemen, the Porsche Cayenne, of course, which for a Porsche badge to be put on a big, high-rising, luxury 4x4 SUV was heresy at the time. You know, for that badge to be taken off of the 911 and the 944 and the 928 and even the Boxster, you know, proper sports cars, to suddenly be put on this big, hulking great 4x4, which claimed to have the front end of a 911, but I think we can all agree it didn't translate very well. It's not a pretty thing, the early Cayenne. But it turned out to be a runaway success, because unlike a lot of these SUVs these days that I'm very quick to slag off, the Cayenne could do both well. For a start, it could actually go off-road, because Porsche didn't really know what their customers were going to be. They almost over-engineered it. So they gave it low range, they gave it locking diffs, they gave it adjustable ride height, they gave it fantastic wading depth. And the result is that the things are almost unkillable, and they're incredibly capable off-road. But on the road, it went and it handled and it drove like a Porsche. You know, you could get it with a V8 or even a turbo one. Inside, it was like a high-riding Porsche cabin, so it was great quality and it felt lovely and it was luxurious and spacious. It aims to do the sporty and the rugged, and it did, unlike 95% of these SUVs do. And as a result, it sold its hundreds of thousands to the point where Porsche now sell more SUVs than they do all the other sports cars put together.
It must be quite hard for you to admit that, Joe.
It was. Yeah. It really, believe me, it pains me to say it, but it did save the company. Porsche were in dire straits financially at the time. The Cayenne was a gamble.
I think it rides and drives and handles exactly like a VW Touareg. So that's...
That is also true. But I've come round to the Cayenne because it has the substance to back up the claims, unlike most of these SUVs. And I'm still not saying I'd own one, but you can't deny the success and the fact it did manage to save the company. And if it didn't come along and it didn't have the success it had, then Porsche as a company probably wouldn't exist, and certainly not in the form it does now.
Well, I think that's it's a really good choice. And again, I suppose a bit like we were talking earlier about Ferrari not being a proper, you know, the Lucci not being a proper Ferrari and stuff. The Cayenne probably wasn't a proper Porsche, was it? But commercially, it was an essential piece of the product mix to ensure that they could still produce 911s and Boxsters and Caymans and all that kind of stuff. So my first one on the list actually is the Mini. I'm going to go with the original Mini.
Of course.
Mini? Explain it to me, Phil.
Yeah, should we have swapped it around? Should you have done the Mini and I done the XJS? Or do you not? Are you not convinced it was a gamble?
I'm going to enjoy this.
I'll let you do it.
I think it was a gamble in as much as it was hugely radical in terms of what it was doing. That's the gamble bit. You could argue that from a timing point of view, it was absolutely perfect. You know, the idea that a modern people's car, technologically advanced, cost effective, was absolutely the right car, so that she wasn't much of a gamble at all. Yeah, I think it was a gamble. That radical packaging and the sort of front engine gearbox, engine shared bit, you know, sharing the oil stuff, and that whole packaging piece was quite groundbreaking at the time. But obviously, we know what happened thereafter. So
yeah, I mean, yeah, fair enough. It was a blueprint, wasn't it? It changed the game. It's I hate to use that motoring cliche, game changer, but it was, wasn't it? So
yes, I think so. And the fact that it survived for so long, its appeal just sort of prevailed throughout numerous attempts to replace or update it, as we've probably covered before. We've got a video coming up actually on the Mini through the ages, so keep an eye out for that in due course. But I just think it's a really interesting story, and actually unusual in the British car industry. There's lots of British Leyland stories of innovation and radical thinking that didn't work, but actually the Mini did.
It could so nearly have been a massive failure, couldn't it?
Should we get on to failures?
Yes. I think we should. Over to you, sir.
So I'm going to go with a car that was incredibly radical and I think very attractive, but didn't go so well. And that car is the NSU R080. Launched in 1967 by NSU, who, of course, were sort of more familiar for motorbikes and rear-engine cars. A big four-door saloon, loads of modern features. I mean, you could put this in the early 80s and it wouldn't look particularly out of place, I think. And it was advanced throughout with its sort of, I've got to be careful how I say this, twin Wankel rotary engine.
I have to beat that if you say it again.
Now, the problem with that was it was very advanced, but it went wrong quite quickly. So, you know, warranty claims is what buried NSU really and sent them into the hands of Audi. So you might get 20,000 miles out of them. You might do a little bit better than that. But essentially, it wasn't reliable enough. And that was the end of it, really. So it was in production for 10 years, but sales weren't massive. Under 40,000, I think. Unfortunately, never hit the heights that it really should have hit.
It is a kind of shame because a rotary engine is a lovely thing, but it's also not really fit for general consumers because the amount of maintenance and attention and oil top-ups and blah, blah, blah that you have to lavish on one for fear of it not surviving, it's just not a viable engine for a general consumer product, and that's a real shame. But yeah, I like the RO80.
Yes.
It's still a pretty car.
I agree. It was, again, quite game-changing, I suppose. I think it looked really good, and the engineering, like you say.
Yeah. But,
Joe, what about you?
I've got another Jaguar, gentlemen, which is that back in the 1960s, obviously Jaguar had a great deal of success in this country and in Europe with the Mark II and various derivatives. And of course, the XJ6 would come later. But they wanted to crack America. And over there, the Mark II wouldn't cut it. That's a compact car over there. They wanted something bigger. So they wanted to challenge all the Cadillacs and Lincolns of the world. So in the mid-60s came the Jaguar Mark X. By European standards, it was vast. It was the longest car in the world at the time. I believe it was the widest car in Europe as well. Even today, it is enormous. It dwarfs any car of its time and quite a lot of modern things as well. However, it launched into a market where you measure a Cadillac in states. And by those standards, the Mark X was not big. So as far as Americans are concerned, it still wasn't big or luxurious enough for them. Not to mention, it launched with the XK 3.8 straight six, which again is what Americans use to power a food blender. So they felt it was too small and under-engined, even when it was later upgraded to the 4.2 as the 420G. So the Americans didn't take to it because it was too small and too underpowered. But by European standards, it was far too big and ungainly. So the Europeans didn't take to it either. So as a result, this genuinely gorgeous car that was really well-engineered and had the IRS in the back, so it actually drove really well, was a failure on both sides of the Atlantic. And as a result, it's near extinct and almost totally forgotten now.
It's a lovely car, though, isn't it? You're right. I mean,
I
think they look great. They've got such presence on the road, but fundamentally, for the intention that they were developed for, it did fall short, didn't it? Unfortunately, but I'd still have one if I could fit it in on the drive, which I probably couldn't.
I'm not sure you could fit it in Oxfordshire.
No. Well, interesting, Joe. You talk about the North American market because my next choice is the Austin/Nash Metropolitan.
Of course.
Kind of looked like a bathtub on wheels. It was designed, I think, with the North American market in mind and the assumption that the American market wanted something a bit more compact and a bit more economical. They designed a car avant-garde American styling. It was quite well equipped, but I'm just not sure it took off in the way that it should have done. And of course, they tried to sell it in the UK, but it didn't really take off here either. And my understanding is that in the course of 10 years of production, they sold, what was it, just over 90,000 of them, which to a North American audience of many millions of car consumers is actually not a great number. So as much as I love its sort of slightly oddball quirkiness, I think it was a gamble that probably ultimately didn't work. So
it's a shame, really, because the concept, I mean, Ford did exactly the same with the 105E Anglia, didn't they? Which is kind of a European-sized car, but with American styling. And that was a runaway success. So the concept wasn't bad. It was just in the case of the Metropolitan, it was just badly executed.
Very much an oddball. Maybe not a gamble, just an oddball. But yeah. Jeff, what about yourself? What's the next one on the list?
We're back onto success, aren't we?
I believe so.
Yes. My choice here would be a gamble, but a successful one. Another Mini, actually, but the new one, the BMW R50 Mini. Imagine taking a British icon, changing it completely, and then building it under a German manufacturer. That's a gamble, isn't it? There was a bit of ill feeling, shall we say, at first, when BMW shut quite a lot of Mini businesses down for using the Mini name, and I think it even shut down a woman who was making cushions in her living room, because they were mini-shaped. There was definitely resentment, and there was definitely that ill feeling you talk about. But on the flip side, the car was a huge success, wasn't it? I mean, it just, waiting lists built up, people were paying more than the list price to buy one in the early days. It was just an absolute huge hit. You know, a small premium hatch with, you know, BMW behind it was what the market wanted. We know the styling had a lot of Rover. I mean, I know it was Frank Stephenson's design, but it was, you know, it was, the development was taking place under Rover for a long period, wasn't it? Taking it away from Rover, I suppose. I mean, they had no choice, and it was the golden goose, wasn't it? But, you know.
Well, and look how well it's done. Yes. In a quarter of a century.
Yeah, it's a fantastic car. Well, we filmed that one for our Generations video that you'll see in a few weeks' time. I forgot how well they drive as well. They are fantastic to drive, even as just a Cooper. And I think that's the thing. Maybe they don't drive like an original Mini, but in their own right, they are a fabulous thing to drive.
Mine doesn't. It must be knackered. But you have to think of the legacy it's created. It's an entire brand now with obviously many derivatives. So
yeah,
it's been a runaway success.
100%. What about you, Joe? What's your next one on the list?
So mine's another success. And it's, again, not quite normally our wheelhouse, a little bit modern, a little bit exotic maybe. So cast your mind back to the mid-2000s. If you wanted a kind of entry-level super sports car, you've got the Porsche 911, obviously. You've got the Aston Martin Vantage. You've got the Jaguar XKR. And then word hits the street that Audi are going to make a supercar. And they do, because in 2007, we got the Audi R8. And no one was quite ready for it, I don't think. For a start, when it came out, it looked fabulous. Bang up to date. Every bit as exotic as any Ferrari or Lamborghini. You got four-wheel drive. It was low. It was mid-engine. It had the 4.2 V8 from the RS4, so it made a great noise. It was over 100 horsepower, 190-odd mile-an-hour car. It was priced to compete with the Porsche 911. So in that bracket, it was relatively affordable. But because it was an Audi, it was also reliable and comfortable and practical and half the price of a Lamborghini Gallardo. And as a result, they sold over 30,000 of them. And it became the de facto entry-level everyday supercar. And while it's not quite a classic yet, I think it's a surefire classic and a great success. The idea of the company that makes, you know, boring diesel retmobiles and family estate cars and the all-road and so on, suddenly making this exotic mid-engine supercar, which in later life would get a Lamborghini V10 as well, and it being a runaway success, fabulous car. Yeah,
they
definitely
are really good. And so they very much live up to the stylish looks and everything. I think they're wonderful. I think it's a good choice. That can see it being a Joe Miller two-car garage, the Rover R8 and an Audi R8.
Audi R8.
So, perfect.
Why not? Brilliant. You'll know I've won the lottery when.
I'll pin another success then, and that's going a bit more modern, the Ford Focus.
Yes.
I think Ford, like a lot of manufacturers, they seem to sort of go back and forth between radical and conservative in terms of their design. I could have chosen things like the Ford Sierra as a gamble that didn't pay off because that was a radical styling exercise that ultimately was left wanting. A bit like the XJS, it just took a long time for the buying public to become accustomed to it. And then it did ultimately start to work. But I think I went with the Focus because I thought I wanted to prove that sometimes these styling gambles do pay off. And I suppose the Focus didn't have much to lose because the Escort Mark 5/6 was such a dud. Go big or go home, as they say.
The only way it was up.
I think what I love about the Mark 1 Focus is that it's got this radical styling, but it's not, I personally like the styling. I think the proportions are good. I think it's aged remarkably well. What's it now, 26 years old as a design? So I think it looks great. I think the interior matches the radical exterior, and yet it's still functional and ergonomic. And the road testers of the day just fated it for just what a wonderful car it was to drive, ride and handling. So much so, I still hanker after one. I'd really like one.
I think all you need is a nice early 1.6 Zutec.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's exactly it, isn't it? You're right. It doesn't even have to be a halo car. It could just be a Boggo standard Zutec model with those lovely, what is it, 5-spoke alloys.
Yeah,
That would just that'd look great.
What about a saloon? Is that a failure?
Don't talk about that.
Well, I like the saloon, but then I'm always a sucker for the underdog thing. Yeah. I mean, no one in their right mind would buy the saloon, would they? But I still would.
Yeah, I would in gold, in a gear spec. 2-litre gear
in
gold. When
it first came out, I had a 2-litre gear one on test for the four-door, and it still drove brilliantly. But then the estates drive as well as the hatch as well. Like, there's just the chassis so well sorted.
They are wonderful.
The proof about the Mark 1 Focus being so good is that the Mark 2 toned it down. The Mark 1 probably still looks fresher.
Yes, agreed.
Yeah, definitely. I'd agree with that.
So I think that says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what's your... Do you want another resounding failure? What's your fourth and final choice, Jeff? So mine is an Italian car, sort of. The Japanese car industry was doing rather well by the late 70s, but there were import levies. So before Nissan went and built its factory in Sunderland, it tried to sort of go in through the back door via Italy and partnered up with Alfa Romeo in the same sort of way that Rover and Honda partnered. And the result of that was, well, should have been beautiful Italian styling and Japanese reliability. What actually happened was the other way around. So a Nissan Cherry body, largely, with Alfa Sud bits, perhaps not as reliable as their Japanese equivalents. And that car, of course, was the Alfa Romeo Arna. Alfa GB didn't even want, so it got sold here as the Nissan Cherry Europe initially. If you were going to go and buy a Nissan Cherry, you'd probably go and buy the Japanese-built and engineered one rather than this sort of hotchpotch. We did eventually get the Arna in the UK, but it only lasted from 83 till 87 as its total production run. I don't think we even got it until sort of 84, 85. So not a resounding success.
No.
Virtually extinct now, of course, but I just kind of like it for its curiosity.
Yeah, it's utterly illogical, isn't it?
But yes.
Like you say, it's probably more a testimony to the car industry at the time. Like you say, the Japanese were encroaching, but they still couldn't kind of breach import quotas and things like that. So this was their way of doing it. But sometimes it meant illogical product lineups, and the Arna is probably the best manifestation of that, really, isn't it?
So, yeah.
Very good. Joe?
Excellent. What's your next one? So my final one, another failure, is a car that... let's rewind back to the 1970s, those troubled days of British Leyland. A car that promised it all, but sadly lived a very troubled life, was, of course, the Austin Allegro. But that is not my choice, because in the few years into production, they thought, I know, how do we salvage this car's reputation and improve its image? It's by making a posh version. Ladies and gentlemen, the Vanden Plas 1500, later 1750. Now, in principle, this isn't actually a bad car. We've talked about them before. Inside, you've got really nice Connolly leather, you've got the walnut trim and a few nice bits and pieces and lovely little clock in there. And actually, it's quite a nice place to be. And the hydrogas ride is quite a luxurious thing for quite a small car. But the outside, with that tragic Rolls-Royce-esque grille sort of crudely stuck on the front end, the whole car looks a bit dowdy and apologetic for it. It just didn't work. Not to mention it was hugely expensive, and the production process involved shipping it from plant to plant. They were finished at Abingdon at one stage, and they were half finished and sent all over the country. And any car built like that generally tends to be one that struggles quality-wise. And you can imagine they did. And as a result, in 6 years, they barely sold 12,000 of them. A fail.
I mean, a premium compact car like the Mini now.
The idea was brilliant.
As a concept, it's fine, isn't it? But
that particular example was not.
As with so many cars of that era, it was an issue of execution rather than the initial idea.
I'll be honest, I'm struggling to dislike it though.
Well, I don't dislike them at all. It's just, it was, let's be honest though, we are in the minority.
It
never quite struck a chord, unfortunately.
Well, my final gamble, I'm going failure as well. Well, I think it was a failure, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm going a bit more modern. I'm going with the BMW E65 7 Series, which replaced the E38, the gorgeous, handsome E38 7 Series, which we've done a video on. You could argue that the E65 took the bullet so that subsequent BMWs could evolve over time and embrace the technology that the E65 introduced. But the styling is ill-proportioned, shall we say. And I think the iDrive thing was absolutely mind-blowing. I've heard stories of people on the launches having to almost sit down and have separate briefing exercises before they were allowed to go out in the car because it was so utterly complicated and bewildering. And I think the interior, even if you could look past the iDrive, which is a bit impossible because it's this sort of cheap chrome-looking joystick thing in the middle, just really basic and bland and not at all like the previous E32 or E38 models. So, I think the gamble to embrace all that new tech and everything just, for me, didn't work. And you could argue, well, fast forward 10 years when the iDrive was very much common across not just BMW, but Minis and stuff like that. maybe it was okay. Maybe it was the gamble work. Maybe it was the sort of sacrificial lamb that allowed that technology to bed in. But
they don't even actually drive that well. But for a BMW, they don't actually handle that well. And the ride is a bit choppy. We did a video comparing it to our X350. And not only does that highlight how good the Jag is, but it highlights how lacking the BMW is. There wasn't a single element that I preferred the BMW. The Jag walks all over it. And sadly, in that competitive market that it was at the time, you couldn't afford to stumble. And the E65 was a trip and a half.
That's exactly right. But well, that wraps up our automotive gambles. There were probably lots more we could have covered. And perhaps for anyone watching or listening, do drop us a line or put a comment about gambles that you've observed. Let's get some ideas from our viewers and listeners. But what are we up to at the weekend then, chaps, or in the very near future? What's our motoring passions driving us to do in the next few days?
Personally, recovering from the IMM, I think.
That's probably understandable.
Yeah, the IMM party nights are something to behold. It's all right.
And you can't get away with it like you used to, Jeff. You're a family man now.
Yeah, that's why I will be at home with the family this weekend.
I think that's very sensible.
I very much think that's a good idea.
And Joe, we've actually mentioned our weekend ahead in the last podcast, but obviously you and I are catching up at Tatton Park on Saturday, so the day after this comes out.
So we're off up to Tatton Park for the Classic and Performance Spectacular, the first of our trio of shows there this year. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be a massive show. It was great last year in spite of the weather. I think it's going to be fabulous. I think we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of cars of all sorts. They're one of the most eclectic shows I've ever seen. Yeah, that's going to be a big one.
I think that's really good and very much looking forward to that. I wanted to flag, because I've not been for a number of years, but Le Mans is just round the corner, actually. So it's not this coming weekend. It's next weekend. And Aston Martin are competing in two categories at Le Mans. And I'm just sincerely hoping that they do slightly better with the endurance racing than they are currently doing with their Formula One effort. But it's also a shameless exercise in me being able to plug our latest Aston Martin driver publication, which is all about Aston Martins in motorsport. So
there's your link.
There's my shameless plug. Have a look in the description and the bios and stuff, and we'll make sure we've got the ability to go and order your copy. But safe to say, Aston Martin is a fabulous brand. You always have to mention James Bond, but you should also mention motorsport in the same breath, because it's had a really good run of success, certainly recently. This bookazine aims to celebrate some of those successes. Anyway, well, look, our final bit is, of course, cars that have caught our eye for one reason or another. So, Jeff, your car of choice.
A lot of cars have caught my eye because one of the excursions from this event that I might have mentioned, the IMN, was to a car museum south of Wroclaw in a place called Alawa, I think. It's very hard. I'm not very good with it. Polish pronunciation, but anyway, it's on the t-shirt. So
there you go.
And one of the halls, well, is there's a huge wall at the end that's devoted to the history of the Fiat 126P. So it has the very first cars, some incredible specials, styling bucks, all sorts of things, and the very last 126P produced in 2000. So wow. A huge amount of history. Really impressive display. I have actually bought a 126 in Poland in 2010 and clattered it back across to Britain. And I owned that for a couple of years. And it just sort of made me miss it, really. So I'd like another one.
Yeah, I've dreamed of doing that.
That's a car that Joe can very much get on board with, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
really definitely. Good museum as well. Really recommend it. So really, really smart.
Excellent. No, that's really good. That's a good recommendation. Thank you. Yeah. What about you, Joe?
So my want of the week is sort of ended up inspired by our dear friend Steph of iDriver Classic. I was scrolling through Facebook and she put a post up about how she's owned hers for something like 15 years or 20 years or something. She says she's on a lifelong mission to get everyone driving Morris Minors. And that, between that and seeing a lovely little traveller trundling around my local town, I've been looking at Morris Minors this week, particularly since I even found a little classified up. Here we go. If I show you one, this is one. I'll hold it up to the camera for those of you watching. Lovely little Morris Minor 1000 there in Essex. It's $5,000, which you needn't spend that much in the world of Morris Minors. For just a saloon, they are still one of the most affordable proper classics you can get into. You can't not love a Morris Minor. They're one of those cars that no matter what your taste is and what age you are, they just make you smile. I think they're absolutely charming. And yeah, I would, again, given the space, I'd go and spend a few grand and I don't care what it is, what saloon, what engine, whatever. I think they're lovely.
That's very good. Every now and again, I go looking for brands that don't really ever register on my radar just to sort of see if I've changed my mind. It's like eating olives. I mean, you just sort of decide you've got to keep trying them to see if you like them. So I started looking at Lanciers.
Okay.
I mean, I do like Lanciers, but I just find myself kind of looking at them and going, no. I stumbled across a 1988 Lancia Delta Integrale. I'll put it out to the camera there.
Oh.
It's supposedly Richard Hammond's. It was once Richard Hammond's car.
Wow. I didn't know the owner.
$39,999. And I'm sure that's worth it all day long. You know, Delta prices, they can go much higher than that. But there's a part of me that goes, I can't ever see myself owning something like that is the upshot. So,
See, that's terrible. I'm sorry, we've just lost a load of listeners for you saying that. What do you mean you couldn't see yourself owning a Delta Integrale?
I know. But at that price, it's a bit like we talked about fast forwards the other week, you know? It's that kind of thing.
Yeah, you can get an HF Turbo.
Yeah, there you go.
Can I buy a Lancia Dedra instead?
Can you find a Lancia Dedra? Is my
one. I then started looking at Beetles. Because you mentioned about Morris Minor. I think I'd have a Morris Minor over a Beetle. I still found myself looking at Beetles to see if I would like one. And I did find one I quite liked, which is this 1974 edition. It's actually Blue Jeans special or something.
Jeans edition. Yeah, they're all yellow, aren't they?
Yeah, it's got this cool...
Look at that.
I love the interior of it. I think it's really great.
So 70s.
I think I'd like to own a Beetle just to see what it's like. I think I'd quite... I've driven a few, but never owned one. So
what about that then? A trio of people's cars, a Fiat 126, a Morris Minor, and a Beetle. How nice
if we
is
can
that?
Get all three together, that would be a lovely group shoot. Let's try and see.
I still have a Mini over all of them, but hey.
Has to drop it in, doesn't he? Every time.
Yes. We've mentioned a Mini a number of times on this call now. So,
sorry about that, guys.
But that's all right.
I do like the Fiat 126.
Well, look, I think that probably wraps us up. We've gone quite long today, but that just means it's more work for Joe to edit it later. So
apologies,
Joe. But, yes, well, let us know, guys, if you've got any suggestions for automotive gambles or wants of the week, or even just sharing what you've been up to in your cars over the recent past. But yeah, don't forget to like and subscribe on our YouTube channel if you're watching there, or drop us a comment and give us a rating on the various podcast platforms, because hopefully we want to spread the word, get more people listening and engaging with us on this mindless classic car chat. But in the meantime, thanks very much for your time, and we'll see you again next week. Thanks for watching.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.